Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, today joined by Herman Pretorius. Let me first apologize for any technical issues that may crop up. I've just moved to the Western Cape and therefore have not entirely set up everything. So that's why you can't see my face right now. But anyway, let's get into the first news story of today. And I guess there's probably only one thing we can really talk about as the first news story, and that's the biggest news story in the world right now. Today, the United States votes for President of the United States. They are also voting for who controls the House of Representatives, and they are also voting to determine who controls the Senate. So we are expecting a change in the Senate. The House is too close to call. And more so even, I think, than the last couple of elections, the American presidential election very much seems too close to call. At least that seems to be the consensus of many polls that have been put out over the last couple of weeks. We saw a race that it looked like Trump was going to run away with as Joe Biden collapsed, but the Democrats did a 5 minutes before the end, last minute substitution of Kamala Harris, and she has managed to stabilize them somewhat. And there are now, I think, a lot of interesting questions about how the polling industry is going to do. There's also, I think, questions about, you know, what the U.S. is going to look like after this election. Things are tense. Things are pretty nasty, I think, it seems to me, in a lot of the American political discourse right now. Herman, what are your thoughts on the U.S. political landscape right now?
I mean, it's become a cliche to say this, and we seem to say this so often over the last few years, but in a country of 330 million people, and these are the two people they put up for election, so for the presidency. So, I mean, what a situation to be in. On the one, the difference between stabbed and poisoned in a way, with both candidates having weaknesses that should, by you know any decent standard, disqualify them from the office they are seeking to gain. But that said, there's a question now whether the election will up the ante or whether it will calm the waters. If Trump wins, if Harris wins, will this new president be able to do what presidents have over the last century or so done and, you know, govern for everyone, not tack to the center necessarily, but really soften the language in the campaign? And that's really a question that it's impossible to answer. On the one side, this is Donald Trump we're talking about, but on the other side, it's his last campaign. If he wins this, he's done. If he loses this, I'm pretty sure he's done. So there might be an incentive for him to stop the campaigning. He's won. If he wins, there might be a reason for him to sort of take the heat out of his rhetoric. I know, you know, naive hope, but there's that possibility. Then Harris running as the sort of the quote unquote decent person in the race might feel obliged, if she wins, to tamp down the rhetoric and try to unite a sort of politically divided country. However, Trump being Trump, I won't be holding my breath for tonal moderation. And a Harris victory would likely be fuel to the fire of many, many leftist causes that in the past Harris, of course, have supported. All the great and grand social issues that the left seem to be driving, that would become turbocharged. Then our hope really turns to the Senate. The Senate will be the next port of call for what happens in terms of government, and that is the appointment of key cabinet positions. The most senior cabinet positions are historically and constitutionally done by Senate confirmation. So if Trump wins, will the Republican Party that is likely to gain the Senate insist on a moderate, pragmatic, centrist, or at least within the Republican coalition centrist cabinet, or will they just roll over for the big Donald? I think the latter might be a bit more possible. On the other side, if Harris wins the presidency and the Republicans, as expected, gain the Senate, will they be able to exert some moderation by their senatorial role attacking what could be a rather leftist drifting government or presidency towards the political center. So neither candidate, I think, has it in them to the waters of American politics. It's now really up to the Senate to fulfill, I think, its historical and constitutional duty of being the slower, less radical, less heated, more deliberative entity that the Constitution meant it to be. So as much as the noise is about the presidency, and as much as I think it's all down to Pennsylvania, and I've been trying to crunch the numbers, and my word, it is as tight as it can possibly be by every stretch of the imagination, as much as that's the headline, the what's lurking in the story underneath is whether a Republican Senate can replace Mitch McConnell, that has been the longtime leader in the Senate, with a new leader with the same seniority, the same strategic acumen, and the same love of the Senate as someone that, like Mitch McConnell, has had, that can lead this deliberative, smaller House of Congress or Chamber of Congress to be the moderating influence that it was designed to be.
That's an interesting question about, you know, in a certain sense, there's a lot of similarities between the candidates in terms of policy, which I don't think was actually true necessarily in the last two elections. Oftentimes you've seen one candidate propose something. For example, Trump proposed not putting taxes on tips, and Harris immediately sort of took that and incorporated it into her campaign. And I think there's a real question as to, you know, how either of these candidates are actually going to govern. Trump is kind of a weird and unpredictable guy, so who knows how he's going to actually govern. It may be different, I think, from how he campaigns. It may be the same as how he campaigns. We don't know yet. And the same with Harris is that she's not actually that well known on the political scene. She's been in the fairly sheltered, waters of California's Democrats, which means that she hasn't had to make a lot of tough decisions when it comes to politics or governing. So what kind of character she actually really is when things come down to it, we actually don't really know. And I think this is one of the things that's causing some of the sort of frustration and uncertainty for analysts like us, is trying to pick out, you know, based on their campaigns, I don't think actually gives us a lot of info as to what they're actually going to govern like. One interesting thing to consider is that Harris has run quite steadily to the center, running away from her very far left positions of previous years. And this is something Joe Biden did as well. Although he wasn't as far left as her, he ran far more to the center as the election approached in 2020. And also before he dropped out of this one, he was kind of moving towards the center. But he spent a lot of time not governing to the center. He was very much, you know, he got on board with a bunch of progressive policy proposals. He used quite inflammatory rhetoric, referring to Republicans as trying to institute Jim Crow 2.0 laws and racializing America, things like that. So he very much, despite promising to be a centrist, completely sort of set that on fire. And I think that's one of the reasons why Joe Biden has become so unpopular. He's got, you know, sort of around a 40% approval rating, even lower in some polls. So, you know, maybe Harris will actually learn the lesson from that, which is that if you promise to be a centrist and then aren't, the voters are going to absolutely despise you. But, you know, there's something strange in the U.S. political system where politicians just don't seem to be able to learn the lessons of the previous round of mistakes. Anyway, exciting stuff to watch, as it always is, and there'll be lots of drama and snot and cheering and celebrating and despairing, regardless of who wins. And, you know, the Americans are often quite dramatic, so I wouldn't be surprised if there's something dramatic coming our way in the next couple of weeks from the US. Any final thoughts on that one, Homer?
Well, I think it is just a question of people should buckle up. I think it's unlikely that this is going to be a quick count. We are looking, I think, at 1, 2, 3 days. So I would say about Thursday-ish, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock South African time, or pardon me, Wednesday, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock South African time. It might be the earliest that we start getting a picture of who won if the polls are correct, and that's a big if.
Yeah, there's, I think, the potential for a significant polling error in one direction or the other. I'm not sure which one, which means that the thing could actually be much less close than the poll suggests right now. What we really won't know, at least until the first returns come in, by about sort of maybe 4 or 5 o'clock this morning or tomorrow morning, we will have a relatively good idea about whether this thing is going to be close or whether it's going to be a blowout. As states like Florida and Georgia finish most of their counts. Okay, very briefly, let's just talk about one of the big stories in South Africa today, which is the state of Johannesburg. This is a recurring theme on this podcast. I met a listener to the show recently as I was buying stuff for my new house in the Western Cape. And he was asking why I moved. And he said, is it because of all the things you talk about on your show that are going on in Cape in Gauteng? And I said, yeah, pretty much. the city of Johannesburg, according to a report in News 24, is basically bankrupt. Just in 2022, the city had a surplus of 1.2 billion rand. And then by the end of the financial year in 2023, was 300 million rand in the red. There are a lot of causes of the losses, but one of the big ones seems to be the fact that the city is just not able to collect money when it comes to electricity and water losses. That's illegal electricity connections, illegal water connections, electricity breaking down, so it's not able to be sold, water systems leaking all over the place, which of course loses money for the municipality. It's not able to be sold. And these are major problems. In fact, a economist at Econometrics has suggested that it may even come to the national government having to bail out the Joburg Metro, which would be a first for one of South Africa's big, big municipalities. How do we get here, Herman?
Failing at the basics. We got here at failing at the basics. Politicians being comfortable rather than courageous. And collection of electricity rates owed the city. The loss of water through damaged infrastructure, the exodus of business through the collapse of infrastructure. I mean, these are rather venomous chickens coming home to roost. The electricity situation was political, with too many politicians not being able or willing to tackle the payment issues that would have made them particularly unpopular in Johannesburg's townships, where there's been a lot of leniency in terms of electricity being used but not paid for by whatever means or reason. That started out very early on in the new dispensation, and it was a problem that got gradually more difficult to solve, where you are now at such a point where if you now try to enforce payment on a large scale, number one, you might not have the resources to actually process those payments. Number two, you might not have the resources to back up any punitive steps or legal steps that might need to be taken to get those payments due. But also you just sit with a massive political crisis where you can alienate millions, hundreds and thousands, millions of voters who have, by the failure of successive governments, grown accustomed to a service delivery that they never paid for. So the electricity thing is just the cowardice of 30 years of no one being willing to take that unenviable task of ensuring electricity payments. Then on water, again, it is an unfashionable job. I mean, to say that I fixed some pipes as a mayor isn't something that grabs headlines. It's not flashy. It's not interesting. It's not exciting. It's not ego stroking in any way. So it falls sort of off the radar. You get nonsense of spending political capital on naming a street after a Palestinian a terrorist who's never been a feature within Johannesburg, and yet we have streets exploding and water pipes simply losing, what's it, a quarter or more of the water available to the city. Again, just basics not being done. Appointments that have, that are bereft of merit, spending that is political rather than managerial and competent. So it is all just the consequences of successive governmental actions that is so depressing. And in the end, I think that that economist is right. I don't see a path out of this death spiral for this magnificent city short of, well, divine intervention, or perhaps less divine government intervention.
Indeed. Something to obviously keep a close eye on, and I think this will be one of the big stories through next year, will be the ongoing crises in Johannesburg in particular. All right, that's all the time we have for today. Apologies once again for any tech issues on my side. Not great sound, that kind of thing. Hopefully it should be resolved either tomorrow or on Thursday. Thank you very much for watching. That's a wrap. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.